Chapter 18. There was the Russian, Will Valentine, on the couch, but this time he was awake. A brand spanking new pizza box was next to him, and one of his Coors Light beers was unopened, but Devine doubted it would be for long. The Russian's appetite for American junk food and beer was apparently insatiable. Devine sat next to him, eyed the pizza and beer, and said, "You know, there are other kinds of food and drink in this country. And this stuff will kill you if that's all you put inside yourself."
"You like little joke."
Valentine grinned, tore off a big chunk of a pepperoni slice with his teeth, and then clacked away on his computer with one dexterous hand. Devine watched this and shrugged. "Okay, that's my advice for healthy living for the week. Got a problem you might help with. It's a weird email I got, but I don't know who sent it. Maybe you can figure it out." Valentine glanced sharply at him.
"Forward me email."
Devine did so and said, "Whenever you can get to it, but the sooner the better. Lives may depend on it." Valentine casually waved this off, though his full attention was on the message now resting in his computer email inbox.
"You Americans, you get too caught up in stuff like that. In Russia, people die all the time. Usually by government. Or too much vodka. But is good way to go, no?"
"No."
"You want pizza?"
Devine looked down at the box and snagged a piece.
"Hey, you remember me being here all of Thursday night, right?" "Thursday? Sure, sure. All the time. Why?"
"No reason." Devine remembered that Valentine had been dead asleep in his room. Even if he misremembered and told the cops differently, they wouldn't believe him. He was Russian, after all. Valentine had not commented on his facial injuries. He might have assumed Americans got the shit kicked out of them on a frequent basis. Maybe the same was true for Russians. Valentine looked up.
"Whoa, dude! This does not look like email address."
"I know, that's the problem. And I can't reply to it."
"You sure you got this over internet?"
"I'm sure." Valentine didn't look convinced, but then his expression changed as he read the message again.
"Wait, Sarah Hughes? Didn't you tell me you dated her, dude? And now she's dead."
"Shit, I forgot I told him about Sarah." Devine eyed the man, sizing up the situation and what his response would be. "Just try to track the email, Will. It's important." He went up to his room eating the pizza and changed his clothes. Jeans and a black t-shirt were his go-to casual attire. His arm and shoulder were still sore, and he went to the bathroom to reapply the ointment on his face. As he was coming out, Helen Spears was standing there in cut-off jean short shorts, with the bottoms of the white pockets exposed next to her muscled thighs, and a red crop top. Her long hair was piled on top of her head and held there by assorted hair clips. God, she was a knockout, he thought admiringly.
"What the hell happened to you?"
"Cut myself shaving." That got him an eye roll.
"You're not as funny as you think you are, but you share that with most guys."
"I plead guilty to that, Your Honor." The light banter ended right there.
"A woman died in your building."
Devine tensed. "Yeah, she did. Sarah Hughes."
"You know her?"
"A little."
"The news said it was a suicide."
"NYPD may be rethinking that."
"Was the NYPD outside talking to you? I was looking out my window. He seemed like a cop."
She seemed more intent and into this than was warranted. He wasn't sure how that made him feel. "Yes, he is."
"What did he want with you?"
"Asking questions, just like they're doing with everybody else." She folded her arms over her chest and looked alarmingly judicial.
"Do you need a lawyer, Travis? I know some good ones."
"I had nothing to do with her death."
"Doesn't matter. Innocent people get sent to prison all the time."
This set him back on his heels, although Devine knew what she said was true. "I'll let you know. Thanks for the offer. Hey, you remember me being here Thursday night, right?"
"Why? Am I your alibi?"
"You can call it that if you want."
"I think so. But then again, I got in late. I remember seeing you last night for sure. I was doing yoga in the dining room.
Last night is irrelevant to the police investigation.
I get that. Let me think about it.
Thanks. How's your studying going for the bar?
New York's is really hard, but I feel good about it.
What kind of law are you going to practice?
Criminal.
Which side? She gave him a look that he couldn't readily interpret.
The side that needs me the most, of course.
She walked off downstairs, and he heard the front door open and close. He crossed the hall and knocked on Tapshaw's door after he heard her tapping away inside. She opened the door and stood there in what looked to be her pajamas.
Yeah?
She said brightly. She had dirty blonde hair that spooled around her narrow shoulders. Her face was button cute, and her eyes danced with both focus and merriment. She was in her late 20s, she had told him, but sometimes, like now, the woman still looked to be in her teens. She was too skinny, but otherwise appeared healthy to his eye. She had bunny slippers on her feet. Her room was a wreck. Devine had seen more orderly spaces after he'd tossed a grenade inside them. The walls were covered in yellow and green post-it notes. She had three large computer screens on her desk. There was a whiteboard that had revenue and profit projections and a business flow chart along with a corporate organizational schematic. He knew that Tapshaw had gone to MIT. Her undergrad degree had been in computer science. He'd also learned that she was a world-class gamer. In fact, she had used her winnings to start her company, she'd told him. She'd also won some prestigious international awards for her out-of-this-world computer skills and overall brilliance. Then she'd tacked on a fast-tracked MBA from Harvard. The burly, beer-chugging Russian downstairs knew his way around computers, Devine knew. But this shiny-faced, skinny young woman trying to build an empire in the love and dating space might be in a totally different league. How you doing, Jill? Ever come up for air or food? He really liked her. She was ambitious but nice and didn't think too highly of herself. He didn't run into too many people like that. And she had a tender smile and a kind, if naive, manner.
Oh, yeah, I had breakfast, I think.
She looked unsure and gazed back into her room as though searching for evidence to back up her statement. It's dinner time. She looked stunned.
Wow, that went by fast. When I go to the office, I usually at least have soup and some coffee, but I've been working here all day.
She fixed on his injuries.
My gosh, what happened to you? Did you fall off your motorcycle?
Slipped in the shower. Valentine has pizza downstairs. You might want to hurry before he finishes it.
Good idea. Hey, are you doing all right?
She obviously knew nothing about his dilemma. Her entire world revolved around Hummingbird. But it was nice that she had asked. No complaints. Look, if you ever take a break, there's a place nearby that has good tequila.
I love tequila.
Well then.
How about next weekend? I know you work long hours.
Thanks for noticing. He grinned. I know you keep kind of busy too. She looked at her note-clad walls.
It's crazy, isn't it? But it feels cool to be, I don't know, building something. Particularly something that people need and could help them.
Beats what I do for a living. Now go get the pizza. If he puts up a fight, come get me.
Thanks.
She fled down the stairs. A few moments later, Devine heard Valentine cry out,
Hey, no, that's... Oh, well, you already bite into it. So, America... But hey, I am American now, so he's all cool.
Devine snagged his bike helmet and went out the back door. Chapter 19. Cowell's suburban palace was quiet tonight, or so Devine thought as he sat on his bike and surveyed the place with a pair of night optics he'd brought back from the war. He figured the army owed him that. Lights were on, people were moving around inside, and there were a couple of normal cars in the front, meaning a BMW 8 Series and a Maserati convertible. You could have bought at least 10 of them each for the cash Cowell had dropped on the Bugatti. Devine jogged across the road and took up position in the hook of a tree in a stand of oaks, which had been allowed to live when they had otherwise clear-cut this area. He could see into a fresh set of rooms from this vantage point. He hadn't seen the Bikini Blonde yet, and there was no sign of Cowell, but the place had 8 garage bays, so the Bugatti could be in one of them. Devine sat there for a few minutes. Remaining motionless for long periods seemed to be counterintuitive when thinking about what a soldier spent time doing, but the more intelligence you had beforehand, the better the eventual fight would go. He shifted out of the tree, hustled over some open ground, and jumped up on the perimeter wall. Then, keeping his upper arms and elbows planted firmly against the wall, he slowly lifted the optics up to his eyes, adjusting the focus. That was when he hit pay dirt. The Bikini Blonde was out back at a table beside the pool. She had on white slacks and a pale blue sleeveless blouse. Blue backless casual shoes completed the fashion pool-sitting ensemble. She looked like she could step right onto a magazine cover. Yet the man sitting opposite her was even more intriguing. His face was bandaged, but Devine had little trouble recognizing Wasp from the Greenwich Village alley. As he looked at them together, sitting close and speaking earnestly, Devine wondered 2 things. First, was Wasp's car the big-ass BMW or the Maserati? Second, were they brother and sister? Because they sure looked like they could be. Then he also wondered about something else. Wasp's being here was one hell of a coincidence, and not one Devine cared for at all. But then again, the bar in the village was popular with folks who worked in the financial district. He'd been there before on some official Cal and Cumley outings with his fellow burners. So if Wasp was there, and he was in the financial field as well, he could very well know Brad Cowell. Devine couldn't hear what either was saying, so he dropped back to the ground, returned to his bike, and waited. He didn't have to wait long. Wasp came out and climbed into the BMW. Devine had gotten that wrong. He'd figured the guy for the Maserati. The BMW pulled out through the gates, and Wasp hit the afterburners. The car roared off, and Devine took up the chase once more. He was not completely surprised when the route took them to Manhattan. The BMW finally stopped in front of a brownstone on the Upper East Side after sliding into a permit-only space. Wasp walked up to the door, unlocked it, and went inside. Devine pulled in across the street and took pictures of the BMW's plate and the home and its address, which were detailed by brass numbers attached to the stone next to the front door. Every window in the place had coverings, rendering his optics useless. He eyed the homes on either side. They were dark. Cars were parked up and down the street. He figured the brownstone was worth 20 mil or more, and the Wasp looked to be no more than 30. Maybe he'd inherited the place. There was a lot of that going on in this town. Devine drove off and headed to Broadway. He looked up the address where Waiting for Godot was playing for another 2 weeks. It was on 45th in the heart of the theater district. The Lombard. He bought a ticket at the box office for the Sunday matinee. After that, he turned toward downtown and soon pulled up to the place in the village where he had fought the 3 men. He parked diagonally behind a car at the curb and looked around. There was no police tape up, and he saw no other evidence of this being any type of crime scene. Maybe Stamos had been telling the truth. He next drove farther south to the Cowell building and stopped in front. He could see the security guard through the glass. Devine craned his neck back to look up to the 52nd floor, where it seemed now that someone had killed Sarah Hughes. And since he had to find out what was happening at Cal that might be illegal, he figured he also had to find out who had killed Hughes, because they had to be connected. And that connection might stem from a Broadway play. And if I don't solve this thing, even with my best efforts, why do I think Emerson Campbell will send my ass right to USDB? He headed to Brooklyn, crossing over the East River via the Brooklyn Bridge. The dark water looked sulky and uninterested in its surroundings, at least to him. A few minutes later, he reached a street and park slope a block over from Prospect Park. It was a quiet and tree-lined neighborhood of upscale homes, many of which had been renovated. Sarah Hughes had lived in one of them, and there were 2 police cars parked in front of it. A cop was standing guard by the front door, and the lights were on inside. A man in a suit came out of the place and looked around. A slender, red-headed woman hurried over to him, and they met at the bottom of the front steps. She had a microphone and a power pack under the back of her blouse, and was trailed by a burly cameraman. So the media has gotten wind that something is up. The suit engaged with the reporter and they spoke briefly, though the cameraman did no filming. This appointment must have been prearranged, thought Devine. When the man turned and walked back to the house, the woman trailed him, ostensibly asking more questions and perhaps wanting to get something on film. Devine couldn't hear exactly what they were, but the reporter obviously had not gotten her fill. However, the man had. He closed the door in her face, and she clearly wasn't happy about that. The uniform stepped forward and motioned for them to leave. She gave him an earful and then turned away to jabber with her cameraman, who had lowered his piece of equipment. They walked back to a van parked farther down the narrow street and emblazoned with the station's logo. A minute later, they pulled off. Devine saw the woman close up as the van sped past. The dented and grimy vehicle said they were with Channel 44, which he didn't even know was a thing. She was around Devine's age, her expression was determined, and she looked like the type who lived only to be in the middle of all the biggest news stories of the day. Devine's attention was then drawn to a cab that pulled slowly down the street and stopped in front of the house. Two people got out, a man and a woman. They looked to be in their 50s. The man was bald and dressed in slacks and a white dress shirt. He looked like death itself. The woman's face held the anguish of the recently bereaved. The man pulled out a large roller suitcase from the cab's trunk, and then the cab drove off. The man put his arm around the woman, supporting her, and they slowly headed up the steps where they were met by the cop. After each of them showed him something, probably ID, the cop spoke into the mic velcroed to his shoulder pad. The door opened a few seconds later, and the same suit appeared. He ushered the couple inside and closed the door. Devine took all this in. Obviously, Yu's parents had just shown up from wherever they lived outside of the country. He wondered if they knew that the official verdict had changed to homicide. If they didn't, things were about to get far more difficult for the couple. There was guilt in thinking your child had killed herself. You would find yourself in what signals did I miss, what could I have done sorts of mind games. But with murder came horror, knowing that someone out there had killed your kid. Your first instinct was to avenge your child. Then, when that emotion died down, things would be looked at more rationally. At that point, the understanding that someone had violently taken your child's life could make you delve into all sorts of personal spaces where most parents would probably rather not go. But if Yu's indeed had been murdered, it was someone at Cowell and Cumley who had done it, and that meant everyone there, including Devine, was now a suspect. Chapter 20. Devine got up a little late, since it was Sunday. By 6 a.m., his workout was complete, and he went back to bed for more sleep. He listened to his body, and it was telling him to slow down and catch up on some rest. He woke at 11, showered off the remnants of his sweaty workout, and then prepared breakfast. Veggie omelet, toast, protein shake, coffee, and a chocolate chip cookie thrown in just for the hell of it. After that, he went back to his room, fired up his laptop, and did some digging. The deeded owner of the Upper East Side property the Wasp had gone into was listed as the Locust Group. He Googled Locust Group and came up with a ton of results, including variations thereof. Some looked legit, with office addresses and websites and lots of info about what they did. But there were simply too many for him to run them all down. As a little diversion, he looked up the term locust online. They were defined as short-horned grasshoppers belonging to the Acridiidae family. They were not known to be harmful to humans. Devine rubbed his sore shoulder and injured face. They may have to rethink that part. But if the sole purpose of this locust group was to own the New York brownstone, it was reasonable to have no business address and no website. And he knew it was common practice for the ultra-wealthy and/or famous to use shell companies to buy property for privacy reasons. Maybe that was all this was. He next ran the license plate on the BMW. Valentine had earlier shown him a nifty and pretty straightforward way of accessing this information. When he'd asked him about it, the Russian had waved a slice of meatball pizza around and snorted,
"The New York DMV? Please. They suck. My nephew can hack DMV and your FBI and your fucking CIA and other letter people. And he is still little baby."
The guy really was a pill. The car was registered to a Christian Fullerton Chilton, with the address being the Brownstone. Devine looked Chilton up online. There was more than one, but he quickly narrowed it down by the middle name and the fact that he knew what the man looked like. He had a Facebook page, but it was private, and thus restricted regarding what he had access to. But there were ways around that, and he hadn't needed the Russian to show him how. He checked the HTML source code, got the numeric ID off that, plugged it in, did a few more steps of URL manipulation, as it was known in the trade, because of Facebook's nonstop battles with nosy jerks like him, like copying profile attributes of some of Chilton's actual friends listed on the page, and then injecting them into his own profile, and Christian Chilton's page was fooled into thinking Devine was his best friend. And since Devine was using a fake online identity of his own to do this, it was highly doubtful that Chilton would be able to reverse engineer to the real Devine. At least he hoped he couldn't. He quickly looked through the photos and posts. He saw some very famous young people and some very famous old people. Chilton apparently got around. He was in a dream car or on a mega yacht in the Med or striding confidently onto a Gulfstream 650. Devine wasn't guessing. Chilton helpfully provided the type of plane in large cap letters. Devine had never ridden on a set of wings like that. For him, an assbuster seat on a C-130 or C-17 transport plane was the way army grunts traveled. You could tell your perch was first class if it actually had a seat and a harness to keep you there. Chilton was also, he proudly claimed, a direct descendant of one Edward Chilton who had sailed over on the Mayflower. As though that really meant something today. And yet it would for some, Devine knew. Chilton listed his occupation as entrepreneur and investor. He had a company named, what else, Mayflower Enterprises. There was a link to that on the Facebook account. Devine went there and poked around. It looked legit. They had done a ton of investments in all sorts of different business spaces. Chilton was the head guy, and he had lots of smiling faces on the website who made up the rest of his team. Devine changed into khaki slacks, a blue short-sleeved shirt, and light brown canvas shoes, and was leaving for the play when Helen Spears approached him, frowning.
"I don't think I can provide you an alibi, Travis. I've racked my brain, but I honestly can't remember seeing you all of Thursday night. You're sure you were here?"
"Yeah, but that's okay. If you don't remember, you don't remember. I'd never ask you to do something you're not comfortable with." She drew nearer and touched his arm.
"I am sorry, Travis. And if you ever need to talk, I'm here for you."
"Thanks." As she walked off, he closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and told himself to not go there. He had too much on his plate as it was. He eyed Jill Tapshaw's door and knocked, but there was no answer. She might have gone into the office. For her, Sunday was just another day to build her empire of shared love. He left and went outside. He wasn't taking his bike this time. He'd opt for the train. As he walked to the station, he wondered if there was something more to Spears's words. But that might just be wishful thinking. Sure, he had a mild crush on the woman, and she might have one on him. But he didn't think it was that. She seemed genuinely worried about him, and he wasn't sure why. It wasn't like they were close friends, and she probably had a dozen prospects a lot better suited for her than he was. He broke out of these thoughts when a vehicle pulled up next to him.
"How about a ride to wherever you're going in exchange for an interview?"
He looked into the face of the smiling but determined reporter from Channel Nosebleed, who wanted to know every damn thing in the world. Chapter 21. "Excuse me," said Devine, because he wanted a little time to process what she was even doing here.
"You're Travis Devine? You work at Cowell and Cumley?" Where a woman was found dead.
And you are?
Rachel Potter, Channel 44. But I'm working my way up to the single-digit stations, and you might just be my ticket.
She eyed her beefy cameraman who was driving.
We have room in the front seat.
What do you want to know?
Whatever you can tell me about Sarah Hughes.
I don't have a lot of time. I have a train to catch.
Then jump in. It's faster driving.
Devine looked around, and then he climbed in as Potter scooched over to allow room. The cameraman took off at a sedate pace, something Devine could tell was prearranged. She took out her phone and hit the record button.
You're Travis Devine, employed by Cowell and Cumley?
I am. Look, I...
And you knew Sarah Hughes?
I did. I think...
And do you know anything about the circumstances of her death?
No, I don't.
What can you tell me about her?
She was nice. She worked hard. She was moving up at the firm.
Did you and Sarah see each other? I mean, other than at work?
Devine eyed her for a moment. This question kept coming up. Hancock had already been sniffing around about it, intimating that Devine had not been entirely truthful. They knew something. They had to. And maybe this Potter woman did, too. Maybe she'd been told last night, in fact, and not by the cops. He put a hand on the door latch. I think we're done here. The driver sped up. Devine eyed Potter. So what are you doing here? Holding me against my will? Should I be concerned for my safety? She eyed him coyly.
Big, strong army ranger with a chest full of combat medals? You could probably kill us both with your pinky.
The woman was right about that, but it wouldn't be much of a challenge. Potter was around 5'4 and 110 in all her clothes. The driver was in his 60s and about 50 pounds overweight, and every breath he exhaled was full of cigarette smoke. Devine probably could take him out with his pinky.
Have you killed anyone, Mr. Devine? I mean in war, not in New York City.
I've always wondered why people find that so fascinating.
Okay, let's focus on Sarah Hughes. Do you know why anyone would want to murder her?
So now that cat was out of the bag. If Potter knew, then it was all over the news. Devine hadn't checked his feed today. He would have to remedy that on the train ride in. Murdered, he said, looking, he hoped, appropriately dumbfounded. Last I heard, it was suicide.
Then you're behind the curve. I broke that story last night, before any of the single-digit stations. My scoop.
How'd you manage that? He asked, thinking that he had learned that it was murder before she had, from Detective Hancock.
I'm really good at my job, and I have great sources. Confidential sources.
Yeah, I saw your confidential source outside of Hughes' house, thought Devine. He hoped the loose-lipped cop had told the woman's parents before they found out on the news.
So getting back to Hughes, did she have any enemies?
How exactly did you decide to pick on me? A lot of other people work at the firm, and a lot of them knew Sarah better than me.
That's not what I heard.
Then what you heard was wrong. And where did you hear that?
Confidential, sorry.
Stop the van.
Oh, come on.
Devine reached a long arm across and slammed the gear shift into park, jolting them to a stop and causing Potter, who was not wearing a seatbelt, to end up face down in Devine's lap. He looked down at her thick red hair planted in his crotch. He said, Hey, don't you want to buy me a drink first before you do that? This line actually got a guffaw from the cameraman driver, but not from Potter. She sat up and looked at him furiously.
You don't want to make an enemy of me.
You're right, I don't, which is why I'm getting out now. But I won't be pressing charges for false imprisonment.
You sound like a lawyer.
No, but I know a really good one, so depending on how you end up playing this, you might be hearing from her.
The First Amendment is pretty broad.
And it cuts both ways. He got out of the van and hustled toward the station. The van zoomed past him, blaring its horn all the way. And he knew it was Potter with her hand on it, her fury still fully engaged. He reached the station and climbed on board just as the doors of the inbound train opened for passengers. He sat down at a window, checked his phone, and saw that the media was indeed now reporting Sarah Hughes' death as a homicide. As the train moved out of the station and toward the city, Devine assessed his current situation. The cops were coming from one end, the press from another. Suicide had turned to murder. The NYPD was no doubt under a lot of pressure to solve the homicide of an upstanding young woman at an upstanding white glove investment firm. And ex-Army alpha male Travis Devine might just make a fetching target. It was clear that his roommates could not provide him with a viable alibi. Valentine had been asleep, Spears could not confirm his whereabouts, and he recalled that Tapshaw had been out that night. And thus he would remain on the suspect list, red meat for Hancock and company. But he had a couple of aces in the hole. Security at Cowell and Cumley was very tight. During non-business hours, you needed a security card to get into the building. Even during business hours, your card was required to access the elevators. Visitors had to present ID and were photographed and signed in at the security desk after whoever they were visiting was contacted and the okay given. Then they were escorted to the elevator by security, and only the floor they were authorized to visit was made accessible. When they were done, the only floor they could punch in and access without a security card would be the lobby. All of the coming and going information on guests and employees was electronically recorded. Devine knew that he and his security card had been nowhere near Cowell and Cumley when Sarah Hughes was being killed. They would not be able to overcome that. But on the ride in to see Waiting for Godot, he thought about all the ways he still might be screwed. He assumed the play might have a whole new meaning for him after all this. Out of the frying pan and right into the pits of hell. Chapter 22. It wasn't the 6:20, but it still passed by Brad Cowell's humble digs. Before Devine had rented his room at the townhouse, he had done some investigating and knew that Cowell lived there and that this commuter train would pass by it. So he had had his eye on Mount Kisco, even without Campbell using a realtor to get him his current home. Devine had thought, however unrealistically, that seeing how and where Cowell lived could be used as an advantage. He might be able to take an observation he made from the train and then use it in conversation with the man to impress him, to help Devine move up the rungs at the firm. None of that had happened. His only meeting with Cowell had been in that large conference room that day with all the other newbies, so now he was stuck every single day seeing how ungodly rich the man was. So much for my grand plan. As he thought about that, he started thinking about his last few months in the army. Roy Blankenship had confided in Devine about his wife's affair, and Blankenship knew that Ken Hawkins was the one screwing his wife. He had told Devine about it. After Blankenship's death, Devine had gotten access to the forensic records via a buddy of his in CID. That was when he had learned a lot about vertical versus inverted ligature marks. It was clear even to Devine, not a trained investigator, that it was murder and not suicide, and he had questioned his CID contact as to why the verdict had come down as Blankenship's killing himself. His friend told him, "The brass doesn't like rocking boats, Travis. The war is turning against us, and the last thing they need is an officer-on-officer murder investigation in the mix." When Devine had told him that was all bullshit, his friend had added, "Welcome to the politics of the United States Army." But after Hawkins had been found dead, his body had shown telltale signs of having been attacked by animals, Devine had gone into a deep depression. He had hated Hawkins for what he had done. He had managed to get the man alone out in the mountains, and then he had unleashed on him, telling him everything he knew, the centerpiece of which was Hawkins having killed Blankenship. At first, Hawkins had denied it, but after Devine laid fact on top of fact, the man admitted his guilt. And then he had come at Devine with a knife. The men had fought, but Devine was younger, stronger, and his inner motor just couldn't be beat by the likes of Hawkins. He had left him there, unconscious, but he had never expected the man to die out there. The official cause of death was internal hemorrhaging, brought on by repeated blows to the head and body, blows provided by Devine. However, the official report was that Hawkins had died at the hands of the Taliban, and Devine had never corrected the record. but he also could not remain in the army with the guilt of what he had done. Thus, the exit from the one organization where he had felt he truly belonged, and his subsequent exile to the financial world in New York, where his old man was so, so proud of him. My own personal prison, with no way out. But maybe Campbell had given him a way. Now he just had to perform. No one was by the pool at Cal's place. There was a gardener pruning a bush. A cardinal landed on top of a table umbrella and performed the short, jerky motions of the head that birds did. The water looked cool and inviting, but for some reason made Devine slightly nauseous. He turned away as the train jolted and picked up speed, and the palace was gone. Devine closed his eyes and sat back in his seat the rest of the way to New York. The city was tough for many natives in the summer. It was crowded with tourists who often had no idea where they were going. But assistance by accommodating locals proud of their city was usually provided, and any confusion rectified. The pavements and buildings absorbed every molecule of heat and threw it violently back at walkers and bikers and drivers. Foul air, driven by funneled winds, could almost burn your nostrils out or lift you off your feet. The subway would blow past underneath, and its thrust would come through the pavement grates with velocity, providing a surprise gust of hot air. Yet he liked the city in the summer more than in the winter. He could sit on a rock in Central Park, or perch on a bench, or take a stroll and pretend there was no one else around. And somehow, in a metropolis of 8 million, it worked. At least for him. He walked to Broadway from Grand Central. When Devine got to the theater, his phone buzzed. He looked down at the screen where a message appeared. Emerson Campbell wanted to meet with him for a progress report. Devine knew why. Suicide had just changed to homicide. He looked around. It was a typical Sunday on a warm summer's day in Manhattan, meaning the streets were packed and people were either leisurely walking along or rushing on their way to get somewhere. Devine moved over to a corner of the street out of the way of passing pedestrians and called the number on the screen. A voice answered, giving him a time later that day and an address. Luckily, it was in the city. For a moment, he wondered if they knew where he was. He looked at his phone. Idiot. If Apple knew where he was, of course Campbell did. He took a seat inside the Lombard Theater, in the back and on the left. The interior had been redone with taste and quality. The place was full, and there was a nice mix of young and old, more women than men. There was a heightened sense of anticipation. The lights went down and the curtain rose, and Devine forgot about most everything else as two performers who had achieved dazzling heights on both stage and screen and were now in the twilight of their careers waited for, well, Godot. Although Devine already knew Godot would not be coming. That was the point, after all. Devine was riveted, just as he was the first time he'd seen a different production 15 years ago. Back then, the teenaged Devine had just made a momentous decision that had resulted in a bad relationship with his father becoming even worse. Consequently, Devine had seen a bit of himself in the portrayals on stage. The waiting, the creeping doubt, the revitalization of spirit, and the creeping doubt once more. Coupled with all that heaviness was another question. Was there really any real meaning in the lives being led by people? Were we all just waiting for nothing? He had come out of the theater back then both sure and uncertain of his decision to join the army, if such things could coexist. And in the complexity of the human mind, he knew they easily could. As could the rationale to take the life of another. He knew that better than most. Now, as a mature man, Devine had a deeper appreciation for Samuel Beckett's tale of two men desperately waiting for something that they could not even begin to define. Devine had thought he would be in the military for the full ride, and then muster out and maybe go work for a defense contractor. Or hell, maybe find an island far away and lie on the beach with stacks of good books. But none of that had worked out. He had gotten his MBA and gone to work for Cal to appease his father. To be more like his siblings, to be a success in the way that success was normally defined, at least in America. but mostly to make himself pay for having essentially killed another soldier, regardless of whether the man deserved it. When the lights came up and the curtain came down for the final time after the actors had performed their bows and filed off the stage, Devine remained where he was sitting and looked around the theater. The seats and the trimmings and the carpet and all the other hundreds of details clearly showed the place had been given some serious TLC. It was good they kept these old structures around instead of knocking them down. Some people would knock down everything given the chance, including other people. But with respect to the reason he had come here, the results were disappointing. Why Hughes had mentioned the play to Stamos, he still didn't know. He knew that Hughes had walked into Stamos's office and told her about Waiting for Godot, encouraging her to check it out. Well, Devine had checked it out, and he still understood not one damn thing about why it was important to Hughes, or whether it was connected to her death, or whatever was going on at Cowell & Cumley. But the more he thought about his conversation with Stamos, the more he honed in on her vague response and her reluctance to go into detail about what Hughes had told her about the play. Maybe she does know, but just didn't want to tell me the truth. She said Sarah was scared. Maybe Stamos is scared too. Something dawned on him. Maybe she thinks I'm spying on her for Cowell for some reason. And if Cowell had something to do with Sarah's death, that would be a reason for Stamos to be afraid and also not reveal the truth to me. But if she was scared of Cowell, why sleep with him? To keep on his good side? To avoid ending up like Sarah? With these troubling thoughts in mind, he rose and left, taking his official program with him, hoping that there might be a clue in there as to why Hughes was so interested in the play. He stood in the lobby and read through it twice, but it was simply a program for a play. This wasn't some obtuse code-breaking movie, where the villain, intent on global domination, conveniently left a trail of inscrutable clues behind, so the forces of good could figure them out and vanquish him. He left the air conditioning and walked out into the heat. He had 1 hour before his meeting with Campbell. He got a Coke and a hot dog with ketchup, mustard, and onions from a street cart, and ate while sitting on a raised wall along with a million other sunseekers. After he finished, he checked his watch and gauged the time to get there. When that deadline hit, he rose and headed off. He was no longer waiting for Godot. He was going right to the source, in a manner of speaking. And Emerson Campbell sure as hell would be there. Chapter 23. Devine ventured up into the land of the 50s now, and headed crosstown between 6th and 7th. It was a long, narrow, pothole-riddled street full of construction equipment and ripped-up asphalt and exposed trenches, and plywood and steel plate pathways with warning signs everywhere. The construction work was thankfully silent on the Sabbath, but the people, heat, food carts, trash, and everything else one would expect in the big city were in full and sometimes malodorous splendor. He made sure no one was tailing him, and then he reached the door of the Italian restaurant with the single green awning, situated precisely at mid-block. It was too late for lunch, too early for dinner, and thus the timing was perfect for Devine's visit. Someone had been watching because the door swung open before he could touch the knob. He walked through and was hit immediately with chilly air from the AC. The door was closed behind him. The person didn't look at him, and he didn't glance in their direction either. There was no need to. He walked right down the short hall. There was no one else visible. Chianti bottles with wicker bottoms were lined up behind the tiny bar, and some metal pizza platters were stacked on an old wooden credenza, along with a mess of laminated menus. The mingled scents of garlic and basil and parmesan and pasta sauce were readily apparent. The stained carpet was cheap and coming up in places. The walls were dotted with photos of long-dead celebrities and the usual cheap prints of Napoli, Roma, and the Amalfi Coast. Bottles of olive oil and single droopy flowers in chipped porcelain vases were on every cloth-draped table. It looked like pretty much every standard Italian restaurant he'd ever eaten at in New York City. He opened the one door at the end of the corridor, just beyond the single bathroom. He closed it behind him and looked at the man seated on the far side of the small table in the room, which seemed instantly claustrophobic from where Devine was standing. Emerson Campbell looked at Devine, and Devine looked back at him.
Sit down.
Devine sat. The older man's voice was low, monotone, and still managed to raise every hair on Devine's thick neck.
Report, Devine. There have been significant developments.
Devine did so. Short, succinct, each sentence packed with meat and no emotion, though he was feeling a great deal. But Emerson did not care about such things, Devine knew. To him, it was all about the mission. He finished, eased forward, and said what he really wanted to say. The cops are bearing down on me. I can feel it. They've been fed info. This will be a problem. And a reporter came to see me. Someone's talked to her. They're trying to tie me to what is now a murder investigation. And I had nothing to do with Sarah's death.
If you're innocent, you have nothing to worry about.
Devine looked at him closely.
Lots of innocent people go to prison.
And I would venture to say that far more guilty people do not.
What's that supposed to mean? I did not kill her. I'm not a killer. He paused and added quietly, his gaze downcast.
At least not that kind. But who knows? Maybe there's no difference.
Campbell steepled his hands and looked at Devine like a judge about to impose a death sentence.
Your actions and inactions led to a fellow soldier's death. But this only happened when it became clear that Captain Hawkins was going to get away with the murder of a fellow officer after having an affair with the man's wife. You went through your chain of command. You tried to do the right thing for the fallen Blankenship. In my time, I stood up to the brass, too, and got my ass handed to me for my troubles. In that way, we are kindred spirits, you and I, which was one reason I recruited you for this mission.
I always wondered if Blankenship's wife knew about what Hawkins did.
Stop wondering. She did, though we can't prove it. And Blankenship had $1 million life insurance policy. Combat death was not covered, but suicide was after 2 years. She got it all and is living fat and happy. Now, you texted me before about waiting for Godot. Theories?
I just saw it. Nothing clicked.
What will you do now?
Keep digging. When we first met, it was believed that Sarah killed herself. Now the police think she was murdered. That changes everything, including my mission for you. Campbell said,
When we first met, my assumption was that Hughes hadn't killed herself. I believed she had been murdered.
Why? I didn't think she would kill herself, but I knew her. You didn't.
Yes, but I know something about Brad Cowell and what's going on there. So if she had found out something illegal was occurring, that is plenty of motive to kill the woman.
You really didn't get into it at our first meeting, but do you have anything definite you can tell me about Cowell and why you suspect something criminal is going on there?
We believe it started when Cowell was gone from the country over 20 years ago for a considerable period of time, and no one seems to know where he went. He then returned and skyrocketed up the financial ranks right after that. There is also little known about where his seed money came from.
Most accounts I've heard think it came from his partner, Anne Cumley.
There is even less known about her.
Look, why would Homeland Security and the Defense Department even be interested in financial crimes? Isn't that for local prosecutors and the DOJ? Campbell looked over Devine's shoulder at the closed door.
My job is to worry about enemies, both foreign and domestic. And right now, we might have both.
Devine tensed. Wait a minute, are you saying Cowell is some sort of, what, spy? For who?
The man had nothing when he left the country over 2 decades ago. And then when he comes back, he's top of the mountain in less than 2 years. Doesn't that strike you as suspicious?
You sound like a conspiracy theorist now.
Conspiracies do happen, Devine, more than you probably think. And it's not just the dollars that Cowell is making. I really couldn't care less about that. But if there's something behind the dollars that attacks the national security of this country, then I care a great deal.
So can you help with the cops and the reporter?
The cops, yes. The reporter, I doubt it. But a reporter can't arrest you either.
Maybe she can do worse. Campbell looked at him thoughtfully, and for such a long period that Devine finally said,
What? Why Wall Street and Cal and Comley? Strange career path for an Army Ranger. Why not? That's not an answer.
Yet, Detective Hancock didn't buy it either.
Well, then?
I can make some money. My old man can be proud of me.
And that's it.
Isn't it enough?
Would you like to hear what I think?
Does it matter if I do or not?
I think you picked an occupation that you loathe, and he did it because he knew your father, a man whom you also loathe, would approve.
And why would I do that?
It's your self-imposed penance, Divine. You let a fellow soldier die. You were never punished for that, and it bothers the hell out of you because you, unlike Captain Hawkins, actually have principles and a conscience. So you left an organization that had allowed you to reach your full potential. You left an organization that you never wanted to leave. And now you're actually in a prison of your own making.
You're wrong. My father was proud of me for the decision I made, and I was happy about his reaction. In fact, we went to dinner in celebration and got drunk together.
You joined the army in spite of your father's wishes, Divine. In fact, you put on a uniform to spite him.
You can't possibly know that. Campbell picked up a file that lay in front of him.
This is your psych eval when you were trying to get into Ranger School. You were quite candid with those folks, as you had to be. You spoke about how your father had been riding you your entire life. Never good enough, never enough like your brother and sister. A disappointment of epic proportions in his mind. You had the well-deserved rep of being stoic about everything, Divine, but not that time. No, not that time.
Divine started to say something, but then didn't.
And do you want me to read the letter the army got from your father? The army keeps every scrap of paper, as you know. And this one was quite unusual. Most parents are proud of their children for entering the service, but not your father. He was also quite candid when he...
Campbell picked up another piece of paper and glanced down it.
Called it a spit in his face. You were going to West Point to serve your country. That you were only doing it to defy him. While his other two children were shining examples of the American dream, you were the poster boy of his personal nightmare.
He laid the paper aside.
His words, not mine. So don't tell me you and your old man were celebrating and getting drunk together, okay? That's bullshit, and we both know it.
Divine looked away.
You left the army, an institution you served proudly and with great loyalty. That was your first act of penance. A career on Wall Street was your second.
And is my work for you my third act of penance?
That's up to you. But the question becomes for you, where does it end?
According to you, I have the rest of my life to give in service to make up for what I did.
So you concede my theory on the matter is correct?
I concede nothing. And what does it matter now?
It only matters, Divine, to you. But I would say this. Life is a long enough journey without having only negative motivations to get your ass out of bed every day. What I'm offering you is, once again, something positive to do with your life and serving your country. And it's not just money-making that's going on at Cowell, Divine. I'm not sure exactly what is going on there, but it's more than the dollars. Now I think it's time we both got back to work.
Campbell inclined his head toward the door. Divine didn't leave the way he came. The door to the rear was standing open. He breathed in the garlic and Parmesan, and the next moment emerged into the heat. In his recurring dream, there was Lieutenant Blankenship on a morgue slab with his throat destroyed. The other person he always saw was Captain Hawkins lying in the Afghanistan mountains, unconscious after the battle between the two. It hadn't been much of a fight, actually. Hawkins had allowed himself to grow too soft, and maybe his guilt was a bit too much for him to put up a spirited defense against Divine's ferocious attack. The thing was, Divine thought the man would wake up and limp back to camp. If he had tried to file charges against Divine, he was going to raise the whole murder scenario to anyone he could. Only the man didn't wake up. I hit him harder than I thought. He walked to the corner, turned, and headed downtown. The cops were going to be coming after him, too, and he needed to do something about that, despite Campbell's assurances of assistance. So Divine had somewhere to go and someone to see. One misstep now, and it was all over.
Chapter 24. He had surveyed the quiet street and park slope for an hour, and not seen a sign of any squad cars or cops. Hughes' house was evidentiary, he knew, but it was also not the crime scene. They might have gotten everything already. If so, he might be screwed. He tensed when he saw a cab pull up and the same couple from the previous night got out. They were dressed formally for an early Sunday evening in the summer. Him in a navy blazer, her in a skirt and heels. He wondered if they had dressed up to go and formally identify their daughter's remains, or maybe they had gone to a church to pray. Perhaps they had done both. They walked up the short flight of steps. He unlocked the door and they passed through. Divine gave it more time. He wanted to let them have a chance to settle if they had just come back from the police morgue, and he wanted to make sure no cops showed up to meet with them on either a prearranged basis or a spontaneous one. 20 minutes later, he eased out of his surveillance spot and walked across the street. He smoothed down his shirt and knocked on the door. It was answered a few moments later by the man. He was around 5'8", with glasses fronting periwinkle blue eyes that were rimmed with red from crying. Divine could see hints of Sarah in him. He had discarded the blazer and the cream shirt under it. He was in a white t-shirt and holding a cup of something.
"Yes,"
he said, his tone and look surprised. He probably knew no one in the area and was not expecting visitors other than the police.
"Mr. Hughes?"
"Yes, who are you?"
He stared up at Divine with a bit of anxiety. Divine knew he could look intimidating as hell to certain people, particularly with his damaged face, and he moved to quickly diffuse any rising apprehension.
"My name is Travis Divine. I worked at Cowell and Cumley with your daughter."
From his pocket, he pulled out the lanyard with the photo security card attached and showed Hughes.
"I'm so very sorry about what happened." Did you
know Sarah, well?
His voice cracked before the end.
"She was the liaison with my group of interns. Everyone thought she was terrific."
"Fred, who is it?"
The woman appeared there. She was as thin as her husband, but paler. Her hair was blonde with white roots. Her face was puckered, her bloodshot eyes wandering aimlessly at first, but then holding on Divine. She had on the same skirt but had shed the pumps. She was around 5'4 in stocking feet. Sarah had been nearly 5'9. Since Fred wasn't tall, there must be heights somewhere else in the family tree, thought Divine.
"This young man knew Sarah,"
said Fred.
"He worked with her at that place."
"Well, please come in, Mr....
Travis Divine, thank you."
"I'm Ellen. This is Fred."
He stepped inside and Fred shut the door. Ellen motioned him to a chair, and the couple sat on the couch across from him. The place was decorated with a blend of Wayfair buys mingled with original creations from the unique shops that littered the area. It was colorful and bright and optimistic, right down to the throw pillows and the rugs over the wooden plank floors. The brick fireplace held pine cones, which was a nice touch, he thought, in the heat of summer. Divine had seen it all before, but when he had, Sarah Hughes was alive.
"Excuse me, would you like anything to drink? Fred just made some coffee, or iced tea?"
"No, I'm fine, thank you."
"So, you worked with Sarah?"
"Not directly, different division. And she was about 6 years ahead of me."
He caught their looks and said, "I went to West Point and then served in the Army for a number of years before leaving. Then I got my MBA.
"Well, thank you for your service, Travis," said Fred.
"I know this must be quite a shock to you both. The whole firm is reeling."
Was there any inkling of a problem?"
asked Ellen. Her voice small, but her hopeful look looming large. Do they not know it was a homicide?
None. She was doing great. I still can't believe that she took her own life. He paused, waiting for them to respond to what he now knew was incorrect information. Fred spoke in a trembling voice.
I know that's what the police initially thought, Travis, but their thinking has changed.
He looked between them.
What? I don't understand.
Ellen glanced down at her lap. She looked like she wanted to leap up and run from the room. Fred said,
The police now believe that Sarah was... that someone... killed her.
He put a hand to his mouth, even as Ellen let out a sob.
Oh my God, I'm so... sorry, this... is stunning.
And even though he knew all of this, now it was stunning to him. Like it was the first he was hearing of it, because he was seeing it through their eyes. Their grief. Seconds passed with nothing but elevated breathing among the three.
So, you two were friends?
She had a lot of friends. She was very outgoing.
She mentioned that she was seeing someone. This was a while back. But she never gave a name.
I don't know about that, he said quickly.
Do you live nearby?
Asked Fred. No, I live way out in the northern suburbs, Mount Kisco. I take the train in.
This is a beautiful place. She did a nice job decorating it.
Had you ever been here before?
Said Ellen, watching him closely. He met her gaze. No, whenever we met, it was in a group, mixers, company functions, things like that. He glanced to the left where he knew Yuz's bedroom was located. Then he looked up to see Ellen's eyes still on him.
But you knew where she lived, Travis.
I walked her home once from a bar near here. We'd been drinking. I just wanted to make sure she got home all right. But this is my first time being inside.
Oh, I see. I hope you didn't come all this way to see us. But I suppose you didn't even know we were here.
I didn't. I came into town to see a play. Then I thought I'd come over here just to look at the place. I was thinking about Sarah, you see. Then I saw you two get out of a cab and come in here. I didn't want to bother you, so I went away for a while. But the more I thought about it, I just wanted to let you know how sorry I was. I didn't know how long you were staying and didn't know if I would have another chance. I was told you were coming in from another country.
New Zealand, answered Fred. I was transferred there. A very long trip.
A horrible trip. Nothing but hours and hours of having to think about.
I'm sure. What sort of business are you involved in?
We're missionaries, spreading the word of Christ. Fred is actually an ordained minister.
That's great. So, New Zealand?
It may seem like an odd choice, but nearly half the people there follow no religion at all. Particularly the young people, which means their children will grow up without God in their lives. And while most Australians who practice a religion follow Christianity, the fastest growing faiths down there are Hinduism and Sikhism.
She frowned at this. Devine looked at Fred, who was staring at his wife.
Now, those are fine religions, Ellen. Lots of people believe that way. I'm just glad they're practicing a faith. They have their God, and we have ours.
My husband and I disagree on some things, but we find common ground where we can.
I hear that most successful marriages do, opined Devine, glancing at Fred before looking back at Ellen.
We just came back from...
She eyed her husband. He finished for her.
The morgue. I can't imagine how hard that must have been. I suppose you just assumed we were her parents,
said Fred, obviously trying to move on from certain images probably gripping all of them.
Partly, but I see some of Sarah in each of you, though she was taller.
My father and brother,
said Ellen with a sad smile.
They're both 6'4". Sarah took after them in the height department.
He hunched forward, deciding to just go for it. Have the police been by? Are they keeping you informed of everything?
They were here when we arrived last night, said Fred. They were already searching her things. I guess they'd do that with anyone, regardless of how she... But now that they know she didn't, that somebody...
Right, sure. I guess they have to do all that. Get her electronic devices, diaries, whatever might help them find out who did this. Fred nodded in agreement.
Yes, they took all of those things, at least the ones that were here. And they looked everywhere, very thorough, dusted for fingerprints, that sort of thing. They were pretty much done when we arrived, so they said we could stay here while we were in town.
He looked around.
She didn't have this place when we moved to New Zealand. She had that little apartment. Where again, Ellen?
Tribeca.
Right, Tribeca. Now she's out here in Brooklyn. I thought that used to be a bad area.
Devine said, it's a lot better than it was decades ago. And consequently, the real estate has gotten really pricey.
Anyway, this is the first time we've seen Sarah's house. We haven't been back until now, you see.
He paused, gumming his lips.
And now we are.
Ellen just stared at the pine cones in the fireplace. She looked like she was puzzled as to why her daughter had not yet appeared and offered her coffee or tea or a hug.
What play did you go see?
Asked Ellen suddenly, her gaze back on him, unnervingly so, Devine thought. Waiting for Godot, Sarah actually recommended it to a mutual friend of ours.
I've never heard of it.
Fred said,
any good?
He seemed to latch on to this line of conversation to escape, for at least a few seconds, what was crushing him. It definitely makes you think, said Devine, who was also thinking that Ellen Hughes would hate it. So I guess she never mentioned it to you? Fred shook his head.
We hadn't heard from her in a while. When was it last, Ellen?
The problem is the time difference. Her night, our day thing. But it had been over a week. She's our only child. Was our only child.
She stopped talking and commenced quietly weeping. Devine started to think all this had been a very bad idea. He rose and said, I don't want to intrude anymore. Again, I'm so sorry, and if there's anything I can do while you're in town. He pulled out one of his cards with his direct business and cell phone numbers on it and handed it to Fred, who took it without looking at it. Devine glanced at Ellen, who was once more staring at him with an intensity he couldn't quite understand.
Sarah did keep a diary, as you mentioned, but it's not on the list the police gave us. They couldn't find one, yet she'd been keeping them since she was young.
That's odd, said Devine, and it did seem odd. Maybe she started keeping everything in her personal cloud. Lots of people do now.
I think Sarah was a very good friend of yours.
Devine felt his gut tighten under her stare.
I liked her. Everyone did.
Ellen took the business card from her husband and gazed down at it for a tense moment.
You're wrong there, Mr. Devine.
What's that, honey?
Said Fred sharply. Ellen turned the card over and over in her hands, like it was hot to the touch.
Someone clearly didn't like Sarah at all.
Chapter 25. When Devine got back to the house, Valentine was waiting for him in the living room, excitement and concern competing for equal time on his features.
What's up, Will?
Dude, the email?
What about it? Did you find out who sent it?
No, it's untraceable.
Well, thanks for trying.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I mean, it doesn't even look like an email address.
No, Travis, it's not that easy. I mean, I could not trace it. People I work with, they cannot trace it either. At first, I think it is some kind of weird spoofing email or maybe hexadecimal.
What? Exclaimed Devine.
Hexadecimal, a base system to simplify binary language computers use. But I dig deeper, and it is not that either.
Okay, but people send anonymous emails all the time, said Divine. Don't they?
There are many ways to sending such messages on internet, said Valentine. Cheap, not so cheap, hard, not so hard.
Divine leaned against the wall. You're going to need to explain that.
New phone number, preferably burner or prepaid with cash or cloned credit card, fake name and info, new email account, Hotmail, Gmail, different browser, using incognito mode, and of course mail. Russia has Yandex webmail, no phone verification needed. Hotmail and Gmail require phone number. But that is bypassed with burner phone. Incognito mode still has location IP address sent with email. But this email has none of that.
So then it's untraceable, you mean?
Not if person you send it to has resources. And by being cheap, you create big problem.
What are the more expensive and better ways?
Use special service to do just what you want, send anonymous email. Built-in premier encryption, spoofed IP address, auto-deletion from whatever server is used, password protect, no personal info required. Good shit like that.
Who does that? Asked Divine.
Many platforms to proxy email. Some legit and reputable, others not so much. They all do that, and do it good. Or you can jump over them and use VPN platform. But don't do free service. They sell data to third party. Use premium service and your IP address goes poof.
Well, whoever sent that email must have used one of those services or the VPN method. When Divine eyed the Russian, the man seemed more serious than Divine had ever seen him. Gone was the pizza and beer caricature of a Russian hacker.
Even with that, you can't hide the computer's MAC address. Every device has MAC address attached to network card. It's like fingerprint.
But this one doesn't.
I think maybe they spoof address, make it invisible.
I thought you said it wasn't a spoofing email.
Does not matter. We can break those systems, no matter which method used,
he said quite confidently.
No matter if MAC address spoofed, that is what we do. But this email was not sent on one of those platforms. It could not be. It has none of protocols required to send message over broadband, including an IP or internet protocol address.
So I guess it has to have all that stuff.
Of course! Travis, get with fucking program!
Valentine sighed and sat back on the couch.
When you send email, sender and recipient IP addresses are in packet. Then it is directed to gateway or router. Then onto higher level network. It does this over and over until it gets to destination email address.
So then how did the email manage to show up in my inbox? Asked Divine. Before answering his own question, someone had to have my email address.
Yes, this is true, but that is easy to get. The big thing, Travis, is we do not know who sent it or how they managed to send it. I mean, we can't even trace message to any portal on internet.
This is getting a little beyond my depth, conceded Divine.
There are basically five IP classes. Classes A, B, and C are used for public and private use. Class D for things like video streaming, TV networks, and such.
That's only four classes. What's the fifth? Asked Divine.
Class E, not reserved for public, mainly used for research, is experimental IP class. If I had to guess, I say your email sent somehow using Class E, but I can't figure out how.
It came in at 9:22 a.m. It said that a custodian found Sarah's body at around 8:30 that morning, and the police were called. So less than an hour later, someone knew she was dead and had details about how she died and where the crime scene was and what she looked like hanging there. And then they sent out a message only to me, as far as I know, that you guys can't trace. That's pretty damn fast.
You have to find out about this, dude. People I work for are freaking out over this. I mean, seriously, freaking out.
How can I find out about it if you guys can't? I'm not a world-class hacker.
I mean, talk to people. Talk to this dude that found body.
Is not being able to trace an email really that catastrophic?
For me, it is end of world. It means what I do goes poof. And it means that bad people on internet, they get away with anything because they are invisible. Get with program!
When he said it like that, Divine began to understand the importance of the situation.
And you knew this girl, Travis. You told me you dated her. Don't you want to find who killed her?
Of course I do. But if I'm going to be snooping around there, I need your help. Divine was thinking about the security database at Cowell and Cumley. He told Valentine what he wanted done.
Give me your login and password, the Russian said.
Divine hesitated. I'm not sure I should do that, Will. Valentine smiled.
I can find out in about 1 minute, dude. But if you don't want my help?
You screw me, I'll kick your ass, said Divine.
Dude,
Valentine said with a smile. Divine emailed it to him, and the Russian's fingers began flying over the keyboard.
How long do you think it will take? Asked Divine.
It's done.
What?
Your employer has bullshit encryption. I email you what you need to get into database.
Valentine did so and said,
And you Americans wonder why you get hacked all the time. It's bullshit.
As Divine walked off, he knew one thing. There was really only one way the sender of the invisible email could have known those details at that point in time.
I think whoever sent me the email also killed Sarah.